discipline, the discipline of a soldier, not the erratic behavior of some wild-eyed terrorist. George, apparently you were a pilot once. How hard is it to hit a 5-story building at more than 500 miles an hour? The Pentagon is only 5 stories high. At 500 miles an hour, had the pilots been off by just a hair, they'd have been in the river. You do not get this skilled at learning how to fly jumbo jets by being taught on a video game machine at some dipshit flight training school in Arizona. You learn to do this in the Air Force. Someone's Air Force. The Saudi Air Force? What if these weren't wacko terrorists, but military pilots who signed on to a suicide mission? What if they were doing this at the behest of either the Saudi government or certain disgruntled members of the Saudi royal family? The House of Saud, according to Robert Baer's book, is full of them, and the royal family, and the country, is in incredible turmoil. There is much dissension over how things are being run, and with the king incapacitated by a stroke he suffered in 1995, his brothers and numerous sons have been in a serious power struggle. Some favor cutting off all ties to the West. Some want the country to go the more fundamentalist route. After all, this was Osama's originally stated goal. His first beef wasn't with America. It was with the way Saudi Arabia was being run, by Muslims who weren't true Muslims. There are now thousands of princes in the royal family, and many observers have commented that Saudi Arabia is on the brink of civil war, or perhaps a people's revolution. You can only behead so many of your citizens, and then before long, they lose their heads and go crazy and overthrow your ass. That is what is on the to-do list for many Saudi citizens these days, and the royals are circling the wagons. A 1999 article in the political journal Foreign Affairs pretty much spelled out why. Like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia would like to leave bin Laden in Afghanistan. His arrest and trial in the United States could be highly embarrassing, exposing his continuing relationship with sympathetic members of the ruling elites and intelligence services of both countries. So, did certain factions within the Saudi royal family execute the attack on September 11? Were these pilots trained by the Saudis? One thing we do know, nearly all the hijackers were Saudis, and they were apparently able to enter the United States legally, thanks in part to the special arrangement set up by our State Department and the Saudi government that allowed Saudis to get quickie visas without going through the normal vetting process. Mr. Bush, why have the Saudis received red carpet treatment? Sure, we need their oil, and yes, they receive the same kissy face welcome from all the presidents before you. But why have you blocked attempts to dig deeper into the Saudi connections? Why do you refuse to say, Saudi Arabia attacked the United States? Mr. Bush, does this have anything to do with your family's close personal relationship with the ruling family of Saudi Arabia? I would like to think that's not possible. But what is your explanation? That this was just some nut in a cave who just happened to be on dialysis? And after you couldn't find this nut, why did you try to convince us that Saddam Hussein had something to do with September 11 and Al-Qaeda when you were specifically told by your intelligence people that there was no connection? Why are you so busy protecting the Saudis when you should be protecting us? Question number 4. Why did you allow a private Saudi jet to fly around the U.S. in the days after September 11 and pick up members of the bin Laden family and then fly them out of the country without a proper investigation by the FBI? Mr. Bush, not that this is personal or anything, but I was stranded in Los Angeles on the morning of September 11. I scrambled to find a rental car and then drove 3,000 miles to get back home, all because traveling by air was forbidden in the days following the attack. Yet members of the bin Laden family were allowed to fly in private jets, crisscrossing America as they prepared to leave the country. Can you explain that to me? Private jets, under the supervision of the Saudi government and with your approval, were allowed to fly around the skies of America and pick up 24 members of the bin Laden family, and take them first to a secret assembly point in Texas. They then flew to Washington, D.C., and then on to Boston. Finally, on September 18, they were all flown to Paris, out of the reach of any U.S. officials. They never went through any serious interrogation, other than a few questions that the FBI asked them, and a request to check each of their passports before leaving. One FBI agent I spoke to told me that the FBI was furious that they were not allowed to keep the bin Ladens in the country to conduct a real investigation, the kind police like to do when they are trying to track down a murderer. Usually, the police like to talk to the family members of the suspect to learn what they know, who they know, how they might help capture the fugitive. None of the normal procedures were followed. This is mind-boggling. Here you have 24 bin Ladens on American soil, Mr. Bush, and you come up with some lame excuse that you were worried about their safety. Might it have been possible that at least one of the 24 bin Ladens would have possibly known something? Or maybe just one of them could have been convinced to help track Osama down? Nope, none of that. So while thousands were stranded and could not fly, if you could prove you were a close relative of the biggest mass murderer in U.S. history, you got a free trip to Gay Paris. Of course, the bin Ladens have been your business associates. Why wouldn't you do a little favor for some old family friends? But to use the Clinton analogy again, imagine in the hours after the Oklahoma City bombing, Bill Clinton suddenly started worrying about the safety of the McVeigh family up in Buffalo, and then arranged a free trip for them out of the country. What would you and the Republicans have said about that? Suddenly, a stain on a blue dress probably wouldn't have been the top priority for a witch hunt, would it? With all that was happening in the days after September 11, how did you find the time to even begin thinking about protecting people named bin Laden? I'm amazed at your ability to multitask. As if bin Laden's over America, Air Laden, wasn't enough, the Tampa Tribune reported that the authorities also found the time to help even more Saudis. Apparently, another Saudi jet, this one a private Learjet, arranged by a private hangar owned by the defense contractor Raytheon, which also happens to be a hefty GOP donor, was allowed to fly from Tampa on September 13 during the air travel lockdown to Lexington, Kentucky, to drop off some members of the Saudi royal family to be with other Saudi royals who had been in Kentucky looking at horses. Two bodyguards for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers were hired to travel along on the flight, and they told their story to the Tribune about how the pilot revealed to them upon returning to Tampa that he had still another run to make to Louisiana. Why, Mr. Bush, was this allowed to happen? A frightened nation struggled to get through those days after September 11. Yet in the sky above us, the bin Ladens and Saudi royals jetted home. I think we deserve an explanation. Question number 5. Why are you protecting the Second Amendment rights of potential terrorists? Mr. Bush, in the days after September 11, the FBI began running a check to see if any of the 186 suspects the feds had rounded up in the first 5 days after the attack had purchased any guns in the months leading up to September 11. Using the instant background check files for gun purchases created under the Brady Bill, the FBI immediately found two of the suspects had indeed purchased weapons. When your Attorney General, John Ashcroft, heard about this, he immediately shut the search down. He told the FBI that the background check files could not be used for such a search, and these files were only to be used at the time of a purchase of a gun, not to find out information on law-abiding, gun-toting citizens. So, the FBI was prohibited by Ashcroft from doing any further investigation as to whether those detained, because they were possible associates of the hijackers, had procured any weapons in the 90 days leading up to that fateful day. Why? because even though all their other rights had been thrown out the window, your administration insisted that they still had one constitutional right that you were willing to protect. Their sacred Second Amendment rights to bear arms and for the government not to know about it. Mr. Bush, you can't be serious. Is your administration so gun-nutty and in the pocket of the National Rifle Association that even though you have not given a nanosecond of thought to protecting the rights of any of the Arab Americans you have arrested, detained, and harassed in the past 2 years, when it comes to their gun rights, then all of a sudden you are the biggest defender of constitutional rights and civil liberties that the nation has ever seen? Do you realize that when most Americans figure out you have protected potential terrorists by stymieing a legitimate police investigation, they are going to run you and Dick and Reverend John out of Dodge with their own six shooters of ballot boxes ablazing? I guess none of this should come as a surprise, considering what Mr. Ashcroft was up to in the summer of 2001. Instead of protecting the country from events like the one that was about to take place, the Attorney General was busy trying to dismantle the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. He said that the government should not be keeping a database on gun owners and wanted the law changed so that the files were kept for only 24 hours. The Senate and the public did not find out about Ashcroft's orders to stop the search for the terrorist gun files until December 2001. When Ashcroft not only proudly admitted to doing this in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, but went on to attack anyone who would question his actions to protect the hijackers' gun rights. He told the panel that critics of his anti-terror practices were providing ammunition to America's enemies. To those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this: your tactics only aid terrorists. But who was the one aiding the terrorists, Mr. Bush? An attorney general who won't let the FBI do its job. An attorney general who won't let the police thoroughly investigate what the terrorists were up to, including the purchasing of weapons. At that same Senate hearing, Mr. Ashcroft held up what he said was an Al-Qaeda training manual. In this manual, he warned, Al-Qaeda terrorists are told how to use America's freedom as a weapon against us. On this point, he was correct. One of the freedoms Al-Qaeda apparently really likes is our Second Amendment. Another Al-Qaeda pamphlet that was originally found in terrorist safe houses in Afghanistan heaps praise on the United States. Obviously, Ashcroft missed all of the beautiful irony. Here's what this Al-Qaeda training manual says. In some countries of the world, especially the USA, firearms training is available to the general public. One should try to join a shooting club if possible, and make regular visits to the firing range. There are many firearms courses available to the public in the USA, ranging from 1 day to 2 weeks or more. Useful courses to learn are sniping, general shooting, and other rifle courses. Handgun courses are useful, but only after you have mastered rifles. In other countries, e.g. some states of the USA and South Africa, it is perfectly legal for members of the public to own certain types of firearms. If you live in such a country, obtain an assault rifle legally, preferably an AK-47 or variations. Learn how to use it properly, and go and practice in the areas allowed for such training. Respect the laws of the country you are in and avoid dealing in illegal firearms. One can learn to operate many arms legally, so there is no need to spend years in prison for dealing in small illegal firearms. Learn the most you can according to your circumstances and leave the rest to when you actually go for jihad. So, Mr. Bush, Al-Qaeda is apparently plotting to use one of our freedoms, the right to bear arms, against us. I truly love how you have rounded up hundreds of people, grabbing them off the streets without notice, throwing them in prison cells, unable to contact lawyers or family, and then, for the most part, shipping them out of the country on mere immigration charges. You can waive their Fourth Amendment protection from unlawful search and seizure, their Sixth Amendment rights to an open trial by a jury of their peers, and the right to counsel, and their First Amendment rights to speak, assemble, dissent, and practice their religion. You believe you have the right to just trash all these rights, but when it comes to the Second Amendment right to own an AK-47, oh no, that right they can have, and you will defend their right to have it, even after they've flown a plane into a building and killed a bunch of people. When this story first broke, you naturally got worried that it wouldn't spin the right way to the public, the vast majority of whom want stronger gun laws. So you trotted out a Justice Department spokeswoman to explain to us that the decision had been reached by senior justice officials after they had done an exhaustive study of the law. Among those spinmeisters was Mr. Viet Dinh, the Assistant Attorney General for Legal Policy. Dinh's justification for blocking the background checks? According to the New York Times, Mr. Dinh ruled that these checks were improper, reasoning that they would violate the privacy of these foreigners. Yes, when it comes to guns, finally the rights of foreigners count for something. But in July 2002, the truth came out, and the General Accounting Office released the Justice Department's actual legal opinion on the matter, dated October 1, 2001, a report that your Attorney General had apparently suppressed. What did it say? That the Justice Department's legal advisors had ruled that, get this, there was nothing wrong with using the gun background files to check if a suspected terrorist had purchased a gun. Did you read that, Mr. Bush? I'll underline it and put it in bigger type so you can read it nice and slow and easy. There's nothing wrong with looking to see if a suspected terrorist bought a gun. Nothing wrong. How shocking. Who else, other than you and John Ashcroft, would think that it's a crime to find out if alleged terrorists were buying guns? The GAO also reported that 97% of illegally purchased guns that were initially approved and then taken back once their mistake was realized would not have been detected if the gun check records had been destroyed in 24 hours rather than 90 days. Your administration talks of the phantoms of lost liberty. Tell that to the men and women who were thrown in jails, not because they were terrorists, but because they were Muslims. And tell me why you think you have the right to find out what books a suspected terrorist is reading, but not what guns he might be packing. Who, Mr. Bush, is really aiding the terrorists here? Question number 6. Were you aware that while you were governor of Texas, the Taliban traveled to Texas to meet with your oil and gas company friends? Mr. Bush, I don't know what compelled me to type in some key words one night on the BBC website, but there I was, punching in the words Taliban, the British spell it Taliban, T-A-L-E-B-A-N, and Texas. And lo and behold, look what popped up on my computer. A BBC story from December of 1997. Taliban to Texas for pipeline talks. The Taliban, as you know, were invited to come to Texas while you were governor of the state. According to the BBC, the Taliban went there to meet with Unocal, the huge oil and energy giant, to discuss Unocal's desire to build a natural gas pipeline running from Turkmenistan through Taliban-controlled Afghanistan and into Pakistan. Mr. Bush, what was this all about? According to London's Telegraph Online, your oil company friends rolled out the red carpet for some of the world's most notorious, murderous thugs and showed them a real good down-home Texas time. First, the Taliban leader spent a few days in Sugarland, Texas, enjoying the pleasures of Western extravagance. The oil men put the brutal bastards up in a 5-star hotel, took them to the zoo, and of course, to the NASA Space Center. Houston, we have a problem, apparently never crossed your mind, even though the Taliban were perhaps the most repressive fundamentalist regime on the planet. If the reverse had happened, and they were hosting you in Kabul, the entertainment would have been the hanging of women who didn't keep themselves covered from head to toe. Now that would have been some barbecue, huh? After Texas, the Taliban dictators moseyed on over to Washington, D.C., where they met with Carl Inderfirth, Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs. Then they went to Omaha, where the University of Nebraska eventually created a special training program for Afghanis to teach them how to build pipelines, all paid for by your friends at UNICAL. During one of their visits there, in May 1998, two Taliban members, this time in the U.S. sponsored by Clinton State Department, took in some more sites, including the Badlands National Park, the Crazy Horse Memorial, Gerald Ford's birthplace, and Mount Rushmore. Yes, it was an amazing amount of hospitality, a fine example of American goodwill and our big generous hearts. Or our love of money and cheap energy. Heck, if the price is right, we'll give anyone a chance. As you know, in the former Soviet republics east of the Caspian Sea, there's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of natural gas and oil just waiting to be tapped. Everyone was trying to get in on the rush, and the U.S. government was more than eager to help them. Even President Clinton was all for the idea of the UNICAL pipeline. The trick to getting our hands on all this booty was in beating the Russians to it, and we had to find a way to access it without having to build a pipeline through hostile Iran. So while UNICAL came up with the idea of running a pipeline through Afghanistan, Enron had been working on their own plan to bring gas from Turkmenistan and pipe it under the Caspian Sea and into Turkey. The U.S. government actually paid for Enron's feasibility study. Enron was also busy with neighboring Uzbekistan, where it was trying to strike deals to develop natural gas fields there. In late 1996, UNICAL had begun looking into including Uzbekistan in its pipeline deal heading through Afghanistan and into Pakistan. And then you, Mr. Bush, decided to get in on the action. You met personally with Uzbekistan's ambassador on behalf of Enron. Enron chairman Ken Lay ended a letter to you prior to the meeting with this little bon mot. I know you and Ambassador Safayev will have a productive meeting which will result in a friendship between Texas and Uzbekistan. Sincerely, Ken. What role exactly did you play in the UNICAL meetings with the Taliban? I'm guessing you knew that the leaders of a foreign country were visiting your state and meeting with people who were donors to your campaign. So why exactly were brutal dictators being wined and dined in your state when you seemed to be so against brutal dictators? Of course, to be fair, you weren't the only one trying to help others make a buck from what is believed to be the world's last vast untapped reserves of oil and gas. There was the Clinton White House, Henry Kissinger, and another former Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, all of them willing to lend a hand. And, of course, there was Dick Cheney. Cheney was then the CEO of the giant oil services company, Halliburton. When not building jails in Guantanamo Bay, ignoring massive human rights violations in order to do business with Burma, and working deals with Libya, Iran, and Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which Halliburton did happily in the 90s, Halliburton built and still builds oil and gas pipelines. In 1998, your future co-president, Mr. Cheney, had this to say about the situation in that part of the world. I can't think of a time when we've had a region emerge as suddenly to become as strategically significant as the Caspian. It's almost as if the opportunities have arisen overnight. And in a talk to the Cato Institute the same year, he revealed this information about Halliburton. About 70-75% of our business is energy-related, serving customers like UNICAL, Exxon, Shell, Chevron, and many other major oil companies around the world. As a result, we oftentimes find ourselves operating in some very difficult places. The good Lord didn't see fit to put oil and gas only where there are democratically elected regimes friendly to the United States. Occasionally, we have to operate in places where, all things considered, one would not normally choose to go. But we go where the business is. Yes, there certainly was business in Afghanistan. After the Soviets were repelled in their occupation of Afghanistan by U.S.-backed Mujahideen fighters like Osama bin Laden, the U.S. quickly forgot about Afghanistan and let chaos take over. The country plunged into civil war. When the Taliban rose to power in the mid-90s, they were met with absolute glee in Washington. Initially, the Taliban were thought to be following the U.S.-approved Saudi Arabian model of good government, strong-hand oppression while giving the West what it needed. This made them a country we could play ball with. Quickly, however, their murderous ways came to light, and American political leaders began to back off. But not the oil companies. Unocal stuck it out and plunged on with their pipeline deal with the Taliban, teaming up with Saudi-owned Delta Oil. Delta is headed by a man named Mohammed Hussein al-Amoudi, who has been investigated for ties to Osama bin Laden. It didn't seem to bother either party that Osama bin Laden had taken up residence in Afghanistan with the Taliban's blessing in 1996, the same year he first issued his call for holy war against the United States. That kill all the Americans jihad talk didn't bother your close friends at Enron either. In addition to their plan to pipe the Caspian's natural gas all the way to the Mediterranean, Ken Lay and his associates were also hard at work on another great scam. They were building a giant natural gas-powered energy plant in Dabhol, India. The Dabhol plant, like everything else Enron cooked up, including your campaign, was a titanic ripoff. And who better to screw the indigent people of India than the same company that screwed its own American employees and customers? But George, I'm curious about something else here. Can you tell me if it was just coincidence that Enron and Unocal were in the same region, one building a natural gas power plant and the other building a natural gas pipeline? Was there something else going on here? See, this is how it looks to me, and please, George, feel free to tell me if I am wrong. Unocal would pay off the Taliban to build their pipeline through Afghanistan and into Pakistan. They were then planning to build an extension on that pipeline that would run into India and stop at New Delhi. At the same time, Enron was planning to build a pipeline from Dabhol to New Delhi where, of course, it could meet up with the Turkmen pipeline, bringing Unocal and Enron together. An alternate Unocal plan had the pipeline terminating at the Arabian Sea in Pakistan, where the gas could be exported. Enron's Dabhol plant would have been a quick tanker ride away. But then Osama blew up two American embassies in Africa, and that was enough for President Clinton to decide he no longer wanted anything to do with Afghanistan. He responded to bin Laden by firing missiles into a Sudanese aspirin factory and a deserted al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. I guess one thing you and every other business student learned in school is that once your country bombs the country you're trying to do business with, the deal is pretty much off. So 2 days later, Unocal suspended their involvement with the Taliban to build the pipeline in Afghanistan and pulled out of the deal completely 3 months later. Suddenly, the Taliban were out billions of dollars, money they desperately needed to fund their regime and to protect bin Laden. I'm not certain, but I would guess, Mr. Bush, that the Taliban were mighty pissed off at Unocal and the Americans for going back on such a lucrative deal. One thing I do know about these crazy Taliban, they hold some mean grudges. But one thing was clear to your friends at Enron and Unocal and Halliburton, Mr. Bush. The Taliban and Osama bin Laden really screwed business up with these two terrorist acts, and Clinton shut the deal down. So, as long as the Taliban were around and giving a home to Osama, that pipeline would never be built. What would be the solution? A new president wouldn't hurt. Clinton was never going to let Unocal, Halliburton, and Enron be in business with these terrorists. So Enron became one of the biggest contributors to your campaign to unseat the Clinton-Gore axis. Cheney hired to pick your vice president, ended up picking himself. Then he picked a bunch of your dad's friends for the other top spots, and you said okay. Then you got appointed president by the Supreme Court. And then? You weren't in office a month when the Taliban came a-knocking on your door. They still wanted those billions from the pipeline deal. 6 days after Cheney set up his secret energy task force, the London Times reported that the Taliban were offering to work out a deal with the new administration that would have involved kicking Osama out of Afghanistan, and had conveyed this to you. Everyone was looking for a little quid pro quo, and it just so happened that you'd installed Zalmay Khalilzad, a former Unocal consultant, in your administration. Khalilzad, now a member of Condoleezza Rice's National Security Council, had attended a dinner for the Taliban during the Unocal meetings in Texas. In October 1996, he told Time magazine that the Taliban are not into exporting revolution, nor are they hostile to the U.S. To sweeten the pot, the Taliban had recently joined America's war on drugs, as Afghanistan was responsible for 75% of the world's poppy crop, the prime ingredient of heroin. This was good news to you. The Taliban banned all poppy cultivation and, after an international delegation traveled to the country and declared it poppy-free, you wasted no time in granting $43 million in humanitarian aid to the ravaged country. The aid was to be distributed by international organizations. This is the kind of aid that our government has almost always refused to give to places like Cuba and a host of other countries in the past. But suddenly the Taliban were okay. Of course, the Taliban still had huge stockpiles of heroin sitting around in warehouses, which they continued to sell. If you pretty much control the market for an in-demand substance, and then you drastically cut the availability of that product, even a failed businessman like you, George, could see what would happen. Prices will go up, up, up. As Foreign Policy in Focus has reported, that meant a kilo of heroin went from $44 to $700. And that's all pure profit in your evil, freedom-hating pocket if you're the Taliban. According to various reports, representatives of your administration met with the Taliban or conveyed messages to them during the summer of 2001. What were those messages, Mr. Bush? Were you discussing their offer to hand over bin Laden? Were you threatening them with a use of force? Were you talking to them about a pipeline? Did you and your administration, as one former CIA operative suggested to the Washington Post, foul up a chance to get bin Laden into American custody? Whatever the case, the talks continued until just days before September 11. There would be no pipeline. The Taliban were out the loot, and the companies who supported you had now lost millions themselves on all the prep that went into this lucrative pipeline. What was going to happen next? Well, we know what happened. Two planes took down the World Trade Center and another one crashed into the Pentagon. A fourth plane went down in Pennsylvania. And you decided to protect our freedom by taking some of our freedoms away. Then we swooped into Afghanistan and sent the Taliban and their Al-Qaeda buddies running, which was a hell of a lot easier than catching them. Most of the big shots escaped. Oh, and we turned Afghanistan over to Unocal. The new American ambassador to Afghanistan? Unocal consultant and National Security Council member Zalmay Khalilzad. And the newly American installed leader of Afghanistan? Former Unocal staffer Hamid Karzai. On December 27, 2001, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan signed a pipeline deal. The gas will eventually flow from the Caspian Sea region, and all of your friends will be happy. Something here just doesn't smell right, Mr. Bush. But it can't be the natural gas. Natural gas is odorless. Question number 7. What exactly was that look on your face in the Florida classroom on the morning of September 11 when your chief of staff told you America is under attack? On the afternoon of September 10, you flew down to Florida. Staying in an upscale Sarasota resort, you had dinner with brother Jeb and then went to sleep. In the morning, you took a jog on the golf course and then headed to Booker Elementary to read to little children. You left the resort between 8:30 a.m. and 8:40 a.m., a good 10 to 20 minutes after the FAA knew they had hijacked planes in the air. No one bothered to tell you. You arrived at the school after the first plane had hit the North Tower in New York City. 3 months later, you told a third grader at a town hall meeting in Orlando that you were sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in and I saw an airplane hit the tower. The TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. I said, it must have been a horrible accident, but I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. You repeated that same story a month later in another town hall gathering in California. The only problem with the story is that you didn't see the first plane hit the tower. No one saw it live on TV, as the tape wasn't aired until the next day. But that's okay. We all were confused that morning. You entered the classroom around 9 a.m., and the second plane hit the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. Just a few minutes later, as you were sitting in front of the class of kids, listening to them read, your chief of staff, Andrew Card, entered the room and whispered in your ear. Card apparently was telling you about the second plane and the part about us being under attack. And it was at that very moment that your face went into a distant glaze. Not quite a blank look, but one that seemed partially paralyzed. No emotion was shown. And then you just sat there. You sat there for another 7 minutes or so doing nothing. It was, to say the least, weird, creepy. You just stayed there in your little kid's chair and listened to children read, listening peacefully for 5 or 6 minutes. You didn't look worried, you didn't excuse yourself, you weren't rushed from the room by your advisors or the Secret Service. George, what were you thinking? What was going on inside your head? What did that look on your face mean? Of all the questions I've asked you, it is this one that has me totally stumped. Were you thinking you should have taken the reports the CIA had given you the month before more seriously? You had been told Al-Qaeda was planning attacks in the United States, and that planes would possibly be used. There had been previous intelligence reports talking of Al-Qaeda's interest in attacking the Pentagon. Were you saying to yourself at that moment, well, thank God they didn't fly into the Pentagon? Or were you just scared shitless? It's okay if you were. We all were. Nothing wrong with that. Except you have taken on the mantle of commander-in-chief, and that means you have to command when we are under attack, not just sit frozen in a chair. Or maybe you were just thinking, I did not want this job in the first place. This was supposed to be Jeb's job. He was the chosen one. Why me? Why me, Daddy? Hey, we understand, and we don't blame you. You looked like a lost puppy who just wanted to go home. Suddenly, this was not the party you thought it would be, and you were no longer the CEO president. You were now expected to be the warrior president. And we know what happened the last time you were expected to perform in a military uniform. Or maybe, just maybe, you were sitting there in that classroom chair thinking about your Saudi friends, both the royals and the bin Ladens, people you knew all too well that might have been up to no good. Would questions be asked? Would suspicions arise? Would the Democrats have the guts to dig into your family's past with these people? No, don't worry, never a chance of that. Would the truth ever come out? Within the hour, you were on a plane. Not back to Washington, D.C., to lead the nation in its defense and comfort a frightened citizenry. Not even to nearby MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, where the Army Central Command is located. No, you ran, first to Louisiana, and then halfway across the country to Nebraska to go into hiding underground. How reassuring that was for the rest of us. For weeks afterward, you and your people pushed the phony story that it was for your own safety because you yourself were the intended target of Al-Qaeda. Of course, the problem with that story is that any dunderhead knew that if hijacked planes are being used as missiles, the last place you want to be is up there flying around in the air in a big target called Air Force One. Maybe someday we will learn what that was all about. To me and millions of others, it just looked chicken shit. And I guess by late afternoon, you figured it looked like that too, and you knew you had better hightail it back to the White House where you could look presidential. From the moment your chopper landed on the South Lawn that evening, your presidency was something no one would or should dare question again. Two nights later, According to a New Yorker article written by Elsa Walsh, you went out to the Truman balcony of the White House to relax and smoke a cigar. It had been a horrific 48 hours, and you needed to wind down. In that private moment, you asked one close friend to join you. As he came in the White House, the two of you embraced. Then you took him out to the balcony where he had a drink that you offered him. The two of you then lit up your cigars and stared out across the ellipse toward the Washington Monument. You told him that if we can't get them, any Al-Qaeda operatives who may have been involved in the attack, to cooperate, we'll hand them over to you. It was an offer that I am sure he appreciated. After all, he was your good friend, Bandar Bush, the prince from Saudi Arabia. As the smoke from the ashes still billowed through the air over Manhattan and Arlington, the smoke from the Saudi prince's cigar wafted through the balmy night air of Washington, D.C., with you, George W. Bush, by his side. These are my 7 questions, Mr. Bush. 7 questions that I believe you should answer. The 3,000 dead and their surviving loved ones deserve no less. And a nation of millions is sooner or later going to want to know the truth and demand you come clean or leave. Chapter 2, Home of the Whopper. What is the worst lie a president can tell? I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. Or, he has weapons of mass destruction, the world's deadliest weapons, which pose a direct threat to the United States, our citizens, and our friends and allies. One of those lies got a president impeached. The other lie not only got the liar who told it the war he wanted, but also resulted in huge business deals for his friends and virtually assures him a landslide victory in the next election. Sure, we've been lied to before. Lots of lies. Big lies, little lies. Lies that brought us down in the eyes of the world. I am not a crook was a lie, and it sent Richard Nixon packing. Read my lips, no new taxes wasn't so much a lie as a broken promise, but it nonetheless cost the first Bush his presidency. Ketchup is a vegetable was technically not a lie, but it was a good example of the Reagan administration's whacked view of the world. Other presidents lied about Vietnam, lied about Korea, lied about the Indians, lied about all men being equal as they kept their personal slaves chained up in the backyard, boatloads of lies for hundreds of years. And when caught in their lies, they were disgraced, punished, or removed. Sometimes. Maybe the reason Bush is still here is that he proved the old